Dr. Frederick Foray is our guest. I'm Paula Gordon. This is Bill Russell. This is Dr. Frederick Foray. You talk about callogenesis, and just to make really very clear that you're not some Pollyanna, one of the things I find so engaging about your big idea, that is the importance of beauty as part of the process of the universe, the creation of beauty, is your clear articulation that and with beauty is ugliness always, and we must accept it and struggle. That the agency, the being part of that, that yes, it's we are moving toward again, being wary of the progressivist part, but that this is an eternal part of the emergence of which you're very interested, about which you're interested. And this forever tension between beauty and ugliness, and we have to pick. That gets us to ethics.
That sure does. Well, I'm not a relativist in that sense, but I believe beauty is always relative to the context. I am a contextualist, and that sometimes in order to create greater beauty, you have to tear something down. You have to whitewash the wall.
Gales of creative destruction.
Absolutely. And I believe that, of course, as over against a mediocre painting, whitewashing the wall might really be a destructive and even a vandalism act. But if you really can then use that whitewashed wall to make something more beautiful, more intense, more parts brought together in a meaningful whole.
Is that the creation of beauty?
That is the
parts
creation of beauty.
Parts being brought together in a meaningful whole?
In an intense way, that's right.
It's a very synthetic process.
It's a synthetic process. And synthesizing.
Right. Not to put it, I mean, again, that's one of those words that sounds pejorative.
Yeah.
But it's not. This is assemblage and reassemblage creation and recreation.
But how do you decide if what you're doing is creating beauty or being a vandal?
Maybe you have to be both at the same, I mean, the same agent is likely to be both. Right? I mean, it's hard, but life is hard. It's the meaning of life, I guess, to be both a maker of beauty and a destroyer of beauty in order to make more beauty. That really is the rhythm of the universe.
I made a flippant remark about not being a destination resort, the creation of beauty, callogenesis. But this really, it looks very powerfully rooted in evolution. And evolution, in not just in the biological sense, but in the universal sense.
Yes.
That things are moving and changing, and as things move and change, what was appropriate here may not be appropriate there. And if you've got agents involved in that process and their experience and their perceptions are different, even with the best of intentions, which we cannot always assume, but with the best of intentions and with thoughtfulness, with experience, with concern, with caring, there's still going to be a difference of opinion.
There really is.
And action.
That is where ethics, and Paula just mentioned ethics, and sure enough, the job of the ethicist, let's assume that ethics is the intellectual discipline of trying to understand and think about the consequences of action and the principles of action, as well as the better and worse of end results, okay? So that all of those things need to be brought together. This requires analytical power, the ability to look at evidence. I mean, I'm awfully happy that Bill has been stressing evidence, because you can't do you can't do ethics without logic and evidence. But, of course, it's in the interest of the creation of the greater good, and my translation of the greater good is the greater beauty. I believe
for
that,
everyone.
Yes, yeah. I believe that in this case, I think beauty is the universal good. But then, I'm not trying to reduce it to the pretty painting.
Well, this is open-ended, though. I mean, I'm listening to this, and it could sound like Plato. that you know there is this the form that is beauty. Yeah. And again, that evolutionary piece, the dynamic piece, is what makes it different because it's going to change.
Right.
And the danger, you know, a lot of the ideologies and philosophies of the 20th century and well before that, the damage, the danger was they became fixed on an answer, mm-hmm. the correct answer, the right way to do it.
And then they demanded everybody else.
And of course, everybody else had to fall in. It's essentially a fundamentalist. And there's a lot more involved, but it's a fundamentalist perspective. And the difference, in what I hear you saying is that dynamism, is the evolution, is the change, there's also volition in this that we haven't talked about.
Volition.
And it seems to me that's also a part of this: the willingness, the will. To engage, to learn, to reach out, to create. All of that is essential. It's not sufficient just for me to sit back and say, I want to gen some cows.
Yeah. No, that's where emotion, that's where feeling really is felt. The volition, after all, is the quest for something, some end in view. And that end in view is what's drawing you, it's what's pushing your behavior, and it's what provides the muscle, to go back to the bad metaphor.
That's okay. I accept muscle. I accept it. Everybody's got muscle. It's fine. Okay. You're not being a sexist. The reason that I, just a moment ago, was saying for everyone, it's very easy in America especially and in Western industrialized cultures more generally, to get obsessive about the individual. We are hyper-individuals in America. We have carried that far beyond any excuse of an extreme. And have completely, she says, in her opinion,
And you're personal individualized.
Yes, indeed. That's it. I say that because it seems to me that we have profoundly lost track of the sense of community. That we are social animals, that we do have responsibilities to other people, whether we like it or not, but these interactions seem to me to be part of what you're talking about. This again, the connectedness, the ecology mm-hmm. of not only humans among humans, but humans in the larger life force, and that then takes you to responsibility, yeah. and so that there's a nice ecology.
It's true, isn't it? We wouldn't even be purposive agents if we weren't in community. We wouldn't have the language, not developed language anyway, if every individual person, or it wouldn't even be a person, mm-hmm. if every infant had to develop language for the first time, we would not get very far. Whereas in community, in family, in larger and larger communities, we are allowed to be more than we could possibly be if it weren't for community. So yes, I think we are created by community in the same way that we create community. I was talking earlier about the context of technology and the way in which we have created that which then shapes us, and the importance of being able to remember that we are also purposive agents within a context of was created, and we can do it otherwise.
I see so many people who are simply hopeless. They get up and they go to work and they pay the bills, but they don't have this sense of purposiveness, and they figure that the man or the machine or somebody has they've lost the ability to influence their lives or the lives around them. And everything I hear you say is energy inducing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is a way of, not to say one is in control, but taking back some element of mm-hmm. feeling that you can do something. Again, back to, this is philosophy?
Counteracting hopelessness is one of the primary roles of philosophy. And of course, it's also one of the primary roles of religion.
And how are those different?
It's one of the places where philosophy and religion really come into a common stem, I think. Now, I have a definition of religion in which I'm not worried about the differences at this level as much as some other people. I don't think religion, for example, requires any definition in terms of belief structures or much less personal deities or life after death. Those things are not universal among religions of the world. And so if they're not universal, they can't be taken as defining characteristics of religion. I think what is a defining characteristic of religion is its being so fundamentally dominant within one's value structure so that it defines for you the sacred, that which is the most meaningful of all things. And that's what religions do, and that's what philosophers try to do. The religious route usually has a greater bearing on tradition, and philosophers are a little more individualistic in the sense that philosophers are not really bound by tradition, except by their own tradition, which is to include speculation, which comes out and stings them on the rear end again when they least expect it.
The danger in both those, it would seem, is dogma. And both philosophy and religion seem to become less than beauty-generating when they become dogmatic.
Religion has an easier time of becoming dogmatic because it does depend so much on tradition. I mean, I believe that is empirically true. I'm not saying it's definitionally true, but it's empirically true that the religions of the world have deep traditions and even have developed a structure of hierarchy and with priests often, not always, but at least holy people, shamans, and so on. And philosophers tend to be more iconoclastic, so easier not to be dogmatic, although philosophers can be dogmatic, as we know, particularly more recently, modern philosophers have been pretty dogmatic in turning their backs on Whitehead.
We'll come back in a moment, either with or without Whitehead. We'll see with Frederick Forey.
If he's here, I'm going to be impressed.
Be with us when we return.